cage-free policy, but they felt hopelessly constrained by the high financial cost of transitioning. After wrapping up his visit, he found himself on a grounded plane at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, delayed by snow. He felt frustrated at the inability to change corporate policies, thinking General Mills and most any other company would be happy to use non-animal-based products and ingredients as long as the taste was the same or better, and the cost was more affordable. Well, a company doing that doesn't exist yet, so why don't I just start one? When he got home, he called Tetrick. They had been friends since they were 15 years old, and pitched the idea. After graduating from college in 2004, Tetrick worked as a Fulbright scholar teaching school children in low-income countries. Through this lens, he developed an interest in both the power of business and food to help others. He went to law school and worked on climate change business law until 2009, when he wrote a column titled "You Can Save the Planet" for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, in which he included one line on animal agriculture. 70 billion animals, about the number of humans who've lived in all of history, suffer from cruel and inhumane treatment inside factory farm walls. For this single factual statement, Tetrick lost his job because the largest pig company in the world, Smithfield, was one of his firm's clients. Hampton Creek has never tried to develop a product targeted at vegans or at ethically minded consumers who can afford niche products. The Joshes simply wanted to take advantage of the inefficiency of feeding plants to animals, then feeding those animals to humans, and instead make plant products directly with lower costs. They wouldn't have to persuade any corporate executives to choose ethics over profits. They would just count on those executives' desires to pay the lowest price possible. Eggs seemed like a great place to start given their ubiquity in food products that are relatively easy to replicate, like mayonnaise, and the particularly devastating animal welfare harm of egg production. The first step in this potentially revolutionary endeavor was to ensure that their plant products could satisfy all the culinary needs of consumers and food professionals. Could their plant-based eggs make a souffle rise? Add moisture and binding to a cake? Emulsify mayonnaise? Scramble in a pan for breakfast? To solve this, Tetrick recruited Johan Boot, former R&D director at Unilever, Joshua Klein, a protein expert who previously worked on a gene therapy for HIV in a multi-million dollar research project supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Chris Jones, former Top Chef contestant and former executive chef at Moto, a world-famous molecular gastronomy restaurant. Jones actually brought an entire crew with him from Moto to support Hampton Creek's culinary research. The San Francisco startup scene is known for attracting big talent, but this was exceptional, and all for a company focusing on egg-free mayonnaise. The key to Hampton Creek's research has been the trial and error testing of a huge database of plants, and the success of that testing has come down to individual species with unique properties, like mung bean protein, which was found to coagulate with heat, making it a prime candidate for plant-based scrambled eggs. Hampton Creek's approach reminds many advocates of the technological revolutions that disrupted other animal-based industries like whale oil, replaced by kerosene and vegetable oil, and horse carriages, replaced by trains and automobiles. In 1898, the first International Urban Planning Conference convened in New York City, not to discuss crime or housing, but horse shit, of which there was more than 4 million pounds deposited in the city per day. City officials could find no solution to the expense, disease, and traffic gridlock resulting from not just manure, but horse carcasses, which were allowed to decompose in the streets so they could be more easily sawed apart and moved. The urban planners gave up 3 days into their planned 10-day conference. But by 1912, internal combustion technology led to more cars than horses in New York City, for the first time, sparing human and animal residents from misery. Controversy. As Hampton Creek perfected its technology and secured significant investments from Silicon Valley titans, the American egg industry took notice. First, in 2015, the food giant Unilever sued Hampton Creek on the grounds that Just Mayo was an inappropriate name for an eggless product. Unilever expected the new company to back down like most small companies do when threatened. But the Joshes were determined, and Hampton Creek stood firm. Balk's experience campaigning against big food companies had taught him what a steadfast underdog can do in this industry. This ignited a public relations fiasco for Unilever, as the media cast it as a faceless Goliath attacking a small, ethically-minded David with a friendly, down-to-earth CEO. The coverage in the first week alone gave Hampton Creek $21 million worth of free, overwhelmingly positive media coverage. Unilever eventually dropped the lawsuit. In August 2015, the FDA got involved. The regulatory agency sent Hampton Creek a warning letter based on mayonnaise's standards of identity, intended to keep food companies from using deceptive labels that mislead consumers. Tetrick fought back again, earning more consumer recognition. Hampton Creek eventually had to make minor changes to the label. It shrank the size of the logo, an egg silhouette with a plant growing in the bottom, increased the size of descriptive terms like egg-free, and added the phrase spread and dressing. Yet, the mayo war continued. Just a month later, and a month before I visited Hampton Creek's office, The Guardian announced findings that the American Egg Board, AEB, had plotted against the startup. The AEB's marketing tactics aren't supposed to include attacks on other industries, but the AEB was nonetheless caught scheming to keep Just Mayo out of the retailer Whole Foods. Emails publicized by The Guardian even included jokes of violence against Tetrick, one asking, "Can we pool our money and put a hit on him?" One official offered to contact some of his old buddies in Brooklyn to pay Mr. Tetrick a visit. Besides sparking another media frenzy, again highly positive toward Hampton Creek, this scandal gave serious credibility to the startup, as it was clearly seen as a threat by the formidable egg industry. This was an encouraging sign to everyone working to defeat animal agriculture. The day I visited the office, news broke that the AEB CEO had resigned after the scandal, leading to yet another round of free, positive press coverage, and showing the power of activists and mission-driven companies to make a significant impact. Unfortunately, in August 2016, Hampton Creek experienced a round of negative media attention. Bloomberg criticized the 2014 buyback program, where contractors were paid by Hampton Creek to purchase Just Mayo from stores. According to Tetrick, this was a quality control program, meaning contractors bought the product from a variety of locations to ensure it had the right color, taste, undamaged packaging, and other features, with a budget of around $77,000, a figure Hampton Creek investors say was verified in an audit by professional services firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, lending a little more credibility to their side of the story. Bloomberg alleged that the real figure for just 1 month of this program, July 2014, was $510,000, a significant figure compared to $472,000 in company sales that month. The media outlet cited statements and documents from former Hampton Creek employees, but I haven't personally been able to find any third-party verification. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission took the report seriously, opening a preliminary inquiry into the buyback program, though this inquiry has since been closed with no finding of wrongdoing. In a CNBC interview, Tetrick called for viewers to think about the broader context of the allegations. CNBC then displayed a graph showing the total sales of Just Mayo, a sharply increasing line from December 2013 to June 2016, towering over a tiny horizontal line that included a brief vibration with the sarcastic label Great Mayo Buyout of 2014. Still, a buyback program with the sole focus of boosting sales isn't unusual for an ambitious startup. In their book, The Method Method, the founders of the eco-friendly cleaning products company Method, which includes Adam Lowry, co-founder of the plant-based dairy company Ripple, discussed in the next chapter, wrote about buying their own products at Target and passing them out for free in parking lots. Walt Disney had his friends call theaters to ask about showings of Mickey Mouse cartoons, and if they weren't being shown, to ask the theater why not. Sarah Blakely, founder of the underwear company Spanx, and the youngest self-made female billionaire in American history, paid people to buy her products and even went into department stores to move her product closer to the cash registers. All of these examples were seen as funny, intimate stories of ambitious people trying to launch small businesses, suggesting that the negative media coverage of Hampton Creek's program was driven more by the attention a story about an ethics-driven company with shady business practices would generate. Toward the end of his interview, Tetrick acknowledged that getting stores excited about Hampton Creek's product was a secondary purpose of the buyback program. In another interview, Tetrick further admitted that there were some purchases outside the company's budgeted $77,000 to check on other store features like pricing and shelf positioning. Late in August 2016, Tetrick told the New York Times that Hampton Creek was still operating at a loss, 5 years after the company's founding. But this is still not that unusual for a tech startup. In fact, Hampton Creek's approach of keeping prices low while it grows to reach economics of scale seems like the right strategy, especially because it is selling to food service companies and other institutions and has a good understanding of how to produce more cheaply at a larger scale. This is common practice in today's tech industry with companies like Uber. Overall, I strongly agree with Tetrick that we need to focus on the broader context. The egg industry is surely guilty of far greater ethical transgressions than Hampton Creek, even if we take all of Bloomberg's allegations as true. Journalists pounce on any controversy surrounding well-known companies like Hampton Creek, especially if those companies pride themselves on ethics. We should constantly remind ourselves that the alternative to these new companies is business as usual, a reality virtually nobody is happy with. That being said, if we read between the lines of Tetrick's statements, I do think Hampton Creek's decision to have employees, not just excited customers, call retailers to express interest in its product was misleading. This might be standard practice for startups, but companies innovating for a more ethical food system should hold themselves to a higher standard. Beyond the direct impact of shady practices, there's a risk of harm to the reputation of the animal-free food industry. Even if a company like Hampton Creek is overall a force for good, one mistake can taint public views of other companies with similar goals and reduce the chance of all of us succeeding in building a better food system. Despite its mistakes, Hampton Creek's transparency is laudable. The company owned up to a lot, such as Tetrick dating an employee early in the company's history, and a failure to correctly label an ingredient, lemon juice concentrate, instead of lemon juice, which it promptly corrected. As consumers and observers of an emerging ethical industry, we should be careful not to give up on imperfect companies that combat the systemic evils of the food industry. This controversy also suggests what a big influence journalists have over new technologies, able to spark public outcry or fanfare on a whim. We'll see these effects again when it comes to how journalists label animal-free food, as their incentive to drive clicks might lead to an emphasis on misleading, negative terms like lab-grown meat. From tofu to vegan turkey. The first vegetarian meats were pea shooters compared to the B-83 1.2 megaton nuclear bomb of the modern plant-based meats. According to History of Meat Alternatives, 965 CE to 2014, a book that introduces itself as the single most current and useful source of information on this subject, the first reference to plant-based food that mimicked animal flesh was a description of the canonical vegetarian protein tofu in AD 965. It said that the magistrate of the Chinese city Qingyang encouraged tofu consumption as a more frugal alternative to animal flesh, referring to it as mock lamb chops and the vice mayor's mutton. Nobody's sure how tofu was first made. It might have resulted serendipitously from an accidental seasoning of soybean soup with unrefined sea salt containing magnesium chloride, a coagulant still used in modern tofu production. This would have led solid white curds to form, i.e. tofu. This is still by far the most popular vegetarian meat, remaining a staple even for non-vegetarians in China and Japan. In the next 9 centuries, we find historical references to seitan, made from wheat gluten with a chewy, often sinewy texture that makes it more meaty than tofu. Yuba, also known as tofu skin or bean curd skin, which is the solid sheets that form on top of boiled soy milk, and tempeh, a fermented soybean product originating in Indonesia with a rich, nutty taste. In 1852, we see the first reference to vegetarian meat in Western civilization. This food was less creative, just a sausage-like mixture made by squeezing together finely chopped turnips and beets. More sophisticated foods developed by the 1890s as cooks combined nuts with wheat gluten to make seitan. The vegetarian community at this time, many of them Seventh-day Adventists, continued developing nut-wheat products over the next few decades. The first recorded veggie burger appeared in 1939, containing soybeans, wheat gluten, peanuts, tomato paste, and seasoning. The veggie burger, arguably the progenitor of all modern plant-based burgers, was developed in the late 1960s, where it was made at Seed, a London macrobiotic restaurant serving the likes of John Lennon and Yoko Ono. It was made from a blend of sesame, soy, oats, and wheat gluten. It was sold in grocery stores as a dry mix that consumers could rehydrate, form into patties, and fry or grill. We lack reliable market data for this time period, but it seems vegetarian food rose quickly in popularity astride the counterculture movement of the 1960s. The most famous U.S. vegetarian meat brand is probably Tofurky, made by the company Turtle Island Foods. In true hippie fashion, the company named itself Turtle Island as a reference to Native American folklore in which the world was flooded and a giant turtle carried the land animals on his back, becoming the North American continent. I remember this story from my own childhood. Like the hippies of the 1960s, it helped me connect with and feel more compassion for the natural world and its inhabitants. Turtle Island released its famous Thanksgiving roast, popularly known by the generic term tofurkey, product in 1995, complete with stuffing in the center. With its first 500 tofurkeys sent out by mail order, Tofurky solicited feedback with prepaid postcards. The product was a hit. One customer wrote, "I have been waiting 20 years for this product. Finally, I'm not a second-class citizen at Thanksgiving anymore." Thanks to media coverage on NPR and the Today Show that year, Tofurky helped catapult vegetarianism into mainstream discourse. Plant-based meat. When I met Oliver Zahn in 2015, he was director of the Center for Cosmological Physics at the University of California, Berkeley. Zahn was a fellow member of the local effective altruism community, a social movement and philosophy based on trying to maximize one's positive impact on the world. In July 2016, I helped the German-born scientist and his family pack up some of their possessions as they prepared to move out of their California home. By this time, Zahn had transitioned to apply his expertise to a mission-driven startup, working as chief data scientist at Impossible Foods, one of the most famous animal-free food companies today. Instead of mapping out the stars to trace the origin of the universe, he was now mapping out plant ingredients to build an animal-free food system. As the team helping with the move grew hungry, Zahn pan-fried burgers for us with some frozen plant-based beef that he had brought home from work. This was my first encounter with an Impossible Burger, what was already being referred to in media outlets as the food of the future. The pink raw patties were visually unmistakable from animal-based ground beef. The first thing I noticed in the cooking process was the distinctive color change to the grayish-brown color of a typical beef burger. The Impossible Burger's outside char was a little crispier than that of beef, and overall the patty looked a little dry, but I worried that I was just imagining differences because I expected the product to be imperfect in some way. When it was my turn to try one, I opened my mouth wide and posed for a picture, then took my first bite. To be honest, I actually couldn't distinguish what the patty tasted like apart from the bread, lettuce, and condiments packed together, so I took out the patty and bit into it alone. I was blown away by the complex, rich flavors and truly meaty texture. I've enjoyed plenty of ersatz burgers, because I lost my taste for meat after being vegetarian for so long, but this is the first one I tried that captured the unique culinary experience of animal flesh. The patty was a bit thin and dry, but overall, I couldn't complain, and I knew that those issues could be fixed in future iterations. As a meat eater who was enjoying the Impossible Burger along with me said, I wouldn't be able to tell this apart from animal flesh. When people taste new animal-free foods, they often fail to appreciate the significant variation that exists within a single food category like a beef burger. How much and what kind of seasoning was mixed into the meat? Exactly how long was it cooked? What was the fat ratio of the ground beef? Was the cow grass-fed? I would guess that the difference between the Impossible Burger and the average beef burger was similar to that between any two beef burgers the average American eats in a year. Zahn heavily qualified our tasting with his own view of the product's issues, especially the imperfections that had been fixed in more recent versions. His critiques were precise, highlighting all the specific tastes and aftertastes of the burger, like how long the iron flavor persisted in your mouth. I wouldn't have noticed any of those issues on my own, but surely Impossible's taste testers, some are vegetarian but most aren't, have much more refined palates. The Impossible Burger is built from the ground up, using isolated plant fats and proteins to fill the same culinary niche that animal flesh does. It aims to satisfy even the most voracious carnivore. That meat hunger has been described by chefs, food scientists, and hunter-gatherer tribes over the millennia. Some cultures differentiate meat and plant hunger, such as the Mikeo tribe of Papua New Guinea, which uses iso-etsu, translating literally to throat unsweet, to refer to meat hunger, and ina-etsu, meaning abdomen unsweet, to indicate a desire for plant-based food. There's no scientific evidence of a hunger specifically for animal meat driven entirely by biology, but the social forces behind it are very real. From beef, it's what's for dinner ads, to the historical association of meat with wealth and prosperity. Impossible Foods and Hampton Creek represent a huge leap from veggie-burgers and tofurkey. In 2008, Tofurkey's founder, Seth Tibbett, explained his product's popularity. People are happy to have something that is easy to prepare and that can cook right alongside the turkey and is served alongside the turkey. Now everybody's got something to eat. It's kind of a peacemaker product, I guess. Contrast that with a 2017 statement by the founder of Impossible Foods. My company's goal is to wipe out the animal farming industry and take them down. This bold founder is Patrick Pat Brown, a former Stanford University biochemistry professor who left academia and committed himself to solving what he sees as the world's biggest environmental problem. Like many vegans these days, he decided it's easier to change people's behavior than to change their minds. Brown felt the food industry was decades behind the curve in biotechnology, leaving wide room for innovation. The stuff we're doing now that's new to the food system was old news 40 years ago in the biotech world. His first challenge was to identify the compounds in animal flesh that construct its meaty flavor so that he could replicate them in plant form. This is no easy task. You can find dozens of active chemicals from hexanol to 4-hydroxy-5-methyl-3-2-H-furanone in beef alone, and these vary widely by the breed of the slaughtered animal, where on their body the meat came from, and even the cooking method. Impossible narrowed its scope by focusing on a specific meat product, Safeway 80/20 ground beef. The search revealed a key compound that Impossible claims is the holy grail of plant-based beef. It's called heme, and it's an organic compound with diverse biological function, most well known for its role in hemoglobin, the iron-containing compound that carries oxygen in our blood. Apparently, heme is responsible for over 90% of beef's flavor, and that gives Impossible a huge advantage in the vegetarian marketplace. Ground beef is about 10 parts per million heme, while chicken flesh clocks in at only 2. In fact, heme is so beefy that adding it to chicken leads taste testers to think it tastes like beef. On the other hand, a 2011 meta-analysis associated heme in red meat with colon cancer, which adds concerns about Impossible's use of the molecule instead of other plant-based ingredients. The Impossible burger also has much more saturated fat than other plant-based meats, which could be both a necessary taste factor and a health concern for some people. Impossible originally found heme in soy root nodules, which are actually colored red from its presence. However, harvesting these and extracting the heme would leave an environmental footprint too big for Brown's taste and would likely come with a prohibitive financial cost. The solution the company found was yeast. If you add heme-coating soy DNA to yeast, the yeast microorganisms dutifully produce the compound for easy harvest. This is the same technology that's been used for decades to produce insulin for diabetics and rennet for cheese. Brown is also leading a plant-based cheese and dairy company called Kite Hill, but despite his ambition and capability, the animal agriculture industry will probably not be dismantled by a single person, even someone offering a superior product. The animal-free food industry needs collaboration and competition to succeed. Fortunately, Pat Brown has met his match in Ethan Brown, founder and CEO of Beyond Meat, who's been described as 6'5" of tanned California muscle with a jawline that could cut diamonds, with the same sort of showmanship we've seen from other industry leaders. Both companies launched their patties around the same time, but they took different approaches to market penetration. Impossible released its burger only in trendy restaurants such as Momofuku Nishi, a New York Asian and Italian fusion restaurant run by celebrity chef David Chang. Chang is a fitting ambassador given his notorious love of meat. Reportedly, when customers complained about his lack of vegetarian options, he responded by adding pork to every dish. Beyond Meat, on the other hand, went straight to the household, selling packages of 2 pre-made burger patties in Whole Foods for around $5.99. An industry source told me that Whole Foods and other large retailers wouldn't carry the Impossible burger because the novel ingredient, yeast-made heme, lacks the highest standard of FDA approval. Beyond Meat also has a history of quality plant-based meats, such as its chicken strips released in 2012 that fooled TV hosts in a public blind taste test. Ethan told me that the final decision to launch the chicken strips was actually made when he and vegan chef Dave Anderson did a casual blind taste test with the company's electrician. Both Ethan and Pat have found investor and consumer support for their shared ambition of reinventing meat. There is a sense of friendly competition rather than antagonism between the two companies, however. They are both often mistaken for the other, and given how much demand outweighs availability right now, each probably benefits from the other's existence. For outsiders like me, who focus on the success of the field as a whole, the rivalry is promising. They are inspired to come up with superior innovations, to work faster, and to build a positive public perception of animal-free meat. There has been friction around certain issues, usually minor ones such as Beyond Meat adopting a marketing graphic with a cow and a speech bubble that looked similar to one used by Impossible Foods. And competition can have downsides in new industries, such as when rival companies drive down prices to the point where neither is making sufficient profit. We should also worry about what happens if corporate interests overtake moral interests, such as if a big food company buys out either company in order to squash the competition. But these developments seem unlikely, and the benefits of doing business in vegan tech are far too promising to pass up, so growing competition in the field is welcome. I also see significant value in the different distribution approaches, restaurants versus grocery stores, as both of these have compelling positives and negatives. And it looks like more competition is indeed on the way, as entrepreneurs are beginning to see the wealth of untapped potential in this space. Other companies are currently growing, such as plant-based meat producer Hungry Planet. The company began when Todd Boyman, a tech entrepreneur and investor, ordered a plant-based burger in a small St. Louis restaurant. When he took a bite, he quickly spit it out and complained to the waiter that he was served someone else's beef burger. The waiter assured him it was plant-based, and as a 28-year vegan, Todd's entrepreneurial instincts kicked in. He spent months tracking down the origin of the burger. He emailed the producer, forwarding emails about the mainstream news coverage of plant-based meat companies. After about 2 years of correspondence, in the fall of 2015, he finally met up with the woman behind the burger, Allison Burgess. Burgess had spent 14 years working on recipes and selling to local restaurants, focusing on unseasoned plant-based meat products like ground beef and pork, so that chefs had as much flexibility with them as they do with animal products. For much of that period, she had worked with vegan chef Freddie Holland, and once the three of them got in touch with Todd's sister Jody, a longtime animal advocate and wildlife photographer, they formed Hungry Planet and began planning out a nationwide expansion centered on the Midwest. Hungry Planet primarily focuses on food service. One restaurant tried 25 different veggie burger recipes before finding culinary relief in Hungry Planet's products. Hungry Planet hasn't received the press coverage of Hampton Creek, Impossible Foods, or Beyond Meat. Indeed, the company prides itself on using minimal technology and making its way without outside investors. Importantly, Hungry Planet shares much of the ambition of the other companies we've talked about. It's focused on replacing animal farming, not on providing premium food options for vegetarians, as plant-based companies have done in the past. Even more companies are being launched that employ new strategies and technologies, like the mass production of plant-based seafood, distributing plant-based meat in India, remember the nation's high vegetarian population, and South Korea, and building a more efficient machine called a Couette cell, which applies the pressure and heat used to make plant-based meat. Plant-based meat is usually made with extrusion, an industrial process by which mixtures of water and plant matter, such as soy and pea protein, are pushed through a long container at high temperatures, after which pressure and cooling align the proteins in the direction the mixture is flowing. These proteins form fibrous structures similar to muscle fibers. Each of these factors, temperature, pressure, water content, ingredients, can be varied to produce a variety of textures. The Couette cell, instead, uses a cylinder made of an outer and inner shell. The inner shell rotates while the mixture between the shells is heated and cooled, stretching the proteins into a similar fibrous structure. According to some European researchers, this is more energy efficient and produces a more meat-like final product than that resulting from the extrusion process. European companies are also making use of lupin, a legume most well known in the U.S. as a Mediterranean snack. Lupin is similar to soy in many ways, but soy has received significant negative attention due to its ubiquity in standard Western diets and purported health risks. While the scientific community has generally dismissed those concerns as unwarranted, in fact, soy has been shown to have substantial health benefits, lupin has the advantage of avoiding any negative preconceptions. Lupin can also be grown in colder climates than soy, making local production possible in much of Europe. The plants are easier to grow without the use of pesticides, fertilizers, or genetic engineering. Genetically modified organisms have faced much more resistance in Europe than in the U.S. Lupin also has a higher content of protein, dietary fiber, and antioxidants. There might be some downsides. Lupin has a lower yield per acre, and currently, the low production volume of lupin makes it expensive and sometimes hard to acquire. Still, further exploration of its viability seems like a wise move for plant-based meat producers. The plant-based food industry has now grown large enough to have its own trade group, the Plant-Based Foods Association, which was founded in 2016 by Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer with over 2 decades of food policy experience. At this stage in the development of animal-free food, when it holds only a small fraction of the animal-based market share, it's often quite difficult to know which of these specific approaches is most effective. What's more likely to succeed? The media-focused, tech-focused approach of Impossible Foods, or the minimalism of Hungry Planet? Lupin or soy technology? Or should we be putting our marginal resources into a trade group instead of directly into business and technology? At this stage, the best approach might just be diversification and innovation. Entrepreneurs or scientists seeing a neglected opportunity should go for it. Throw different strategies at the wall. See what sticks, and then consolidate. If you can't beat them, join them. The titans of the food industry can be easy to portray as the enemy of innovation and moral progress. It is true that big food companies are the largest purchasers of conventional meat, dairy, and eggs. However, social movements need resources, financial, political, social, and more, to succeed, and these companies have plenty. They have money, factories, expert chefs and food professionals, distribution channels, and other essential tools for moving food from farms to the masses. If these companies start supporting the animal-free food industry, not only does that industry acquire some of animal agriculture's resources, but it might also result in fewer resources going to their other activities, namely the production of animal-based foods. To put it another way, isn't it harder to take down the multi-billion-dollar meat, dairy, and egg industries than to inspire them to switch their production to animal-free versions? There's already been some investment from food giants, such as the 2016 venture capital investment from General Mills in Kite Hill, the nut-based cheese and yogurt company led by Pat Brown. In 2016, Tyson Foods, the most well-known U.S. meat company, invested an undisclosed amount for a 5% share in Beyond Meat. Its CEO later said he thinks plant-based is the future of meat. Beyond Meat CEO Ethan Brown wrote an open letter explaining the decision to let Tyson invest. He noted that Beyond Meat's most ardent supporters might feel uncomfortable with the partnership and conceded that Tyson executives' beliefs don't comport with his on animals, but he highlighted the common interest of both businesses in sustainable protein and innovation, as well as the power Tyson brought to the table as a company that touches 2 of 5 plates in the United States. In fact, even Unilever has hopped on the bandwagon, releasing its own eggless mayonnaise shortly after its arduous and failed opposition to Just Mayo. Its product was cautiously labeled carefully crafted dressing and sandwich spread, with vegan centered on the front label. An often overlooked leader in the plant-based food world is Whole Foods, and its vegan CEO, John Mackey. Whole Foods was the first retailer to sell Just Mayo, playing a crucial role in Hampton Creek's success, and the first to sell the Beyond Burger, which helped Beyond Meat achieve national media attention and impressive sales. The burgers sold out of the first store to stock them within an hour. Whole Foods has also set precedent for considering the interests of farmed animals with its leading animal welfare standards. The Global Animal Partnership 5-Step Rating Program is recognized as one of the most useful in the U.S., though undercover investigations have suggested that the standards and enforcement are still seriously lacking. It's easy to forget the quiet steps Whole Foods and other retailers have taken by producing their own generic brands of plant-based meat and dairy. While these products usually don't break new ground in terms of media attention or new technology, they provide quality, affordable products for consumers trying to eat more plant-based foods. Even Wegmans, a New England grocery chain with only 95 stores, has an extensive line of its own meat-free chicken nuggets, beef strips, and more. Major investors are also predicting shifts away from conventional animal products. The leader in this field is Jeremy Collar, a longtime vegetarian and major investor in the UK. For his 50th birthday, Collar decided to use the influence he had accumulated over a successful career for an ambitious goal, ending factory farming within 40 years. Collar launched the Farm Animal Investment Risk and Return FAIR initiative in 2015 with the aim of raising awareness among investors about the material risks of the massive global growth in factory farming. As of July 2017, FAIR has $3.8 trillion in assets under management, all committed to the consideration of farmed animal welfare as an environmental, social, and governance issue when the asset holders decide where to invest. Similarly, a group of Tyson Foods investors banded together in 2016 to urge the company to address animal welfare issues in its supply chain and the growing popularity of plant-based foods. Investor pressure might have influenced Tyson's decision to invest in Beyond Meat. These major investors are also following the lead of a small group of trailblazers known as the Vegan Mafia, dedicated early-stage funders like 50 Years and Stray Dog Capital, who have been incubating the nascent industry since 2015. In fact, Tyson is a window into and preview of the broader evolution of the farmed animal movement. The company has been the target of numerous undercover investigations and public pressure campaigns since the 2000s. Yet, it was among the first major meat companies to invest in plant-based meat. In a few years, it could be leading the charge for the future of protein, mass-producing the inventions of startups like Beyond Meat. When I ask animal-free food leaders what progress they're most excited about, the most common answer is interest from big food. This is the most likely route for animal-free food to take a large portion of the conventional industry's market share. 4. How plant-based will take over. Smart companies and impressive products were enough to create today's animal-free food sector, but it will take more to change a significant share of the world's animal consumption. We need to overcome the regulatory and cross-industry entrenchment of animal farming, as well as the biases that keep modern consumers in the habit of eating products of animal exploitation. We also need to weigh different market strategies. Should animal-free food companies stay small and maintain the highest ethical standards, or aim broad and bring in more mainstream investors that could potentially harm the company's mission? Should animal-free food companies focus only on creating products that will reduce the most suffering, such as fish and chicken meat, or products that are easier to make, such as cheese and milk? To tackle these questions and successfully grow the industry, the movement will need visionary nonprofits and non-commercial actors to coordinate technological development and public dialogue. This kind of advocacy can help companies not just gain traction in the short term, but build a competitive industry that can meet animal agriculture on its own terms. No organization has done more in this regard than the Good Food Institute, GFI. Wrangling an upstart industry. GFI was the brainchild of Mercy for Animals, MFA, the charity discussed earlier for its leadership in undercover investigations. As an organization committed to the principle of effective altruism, MFA constantly reevaluates its programs and changes course if needed in order to increase its impact. By 2014, it had grown increasingly worried about the ability of social change alone to fix our broken food system. MFA saw that animal-free food activism gained steam in the U.S. around 2000, but the subsequent drop in animal product consumption over the next decade was not as significant as many expected. In fact, it really just leveled off the previous steep upward trend. and there was rapidly increasing consumption in other countries like Brazil, China, and India. If those countries follow the United States' footsteps into the deep piles of factory farm chicken shit, they will endure the same tragedies of animal suffering, resource depletion, and public health crises. The key strategic insight for MFA was that public opposition to factory farming is far ahead of the public's actual consumption choices, meaning that bridging this gap could be low-hanging fruit for thoughtful advocates. After a year and a half of research by their leadership, particularly Nathan Runkel, Nick Cooney, and Derek Coons, they decided to incubate a new nonprofit organization that supports the development and marketing of animal-free meat, dairy, and eggs. This new organization would focus on business and food technology instead of the traditional activism focus on consumption. While activists had made substantial progress in increasing demand for animal-free foods, the premise of GFI was to put more resources into the relatively neglected strategy of increasing the supply of animal-free foods. MFA needed to recruit an outstanding executive director to lead the initiative. The nonprofit had its sights set on one veteran animal advocacy nonprofit leader in particular, Bruce Friedrich. At this point, Friedrich had served for 13 years at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals as Vice President of International Grassroots Campaigns and for 4 years as Farm Sanctuary's Director of Policy and Advocacy. Friedrich is currently known in the animal protection community for his cool head and strategic approach. He co-authored The Animal Activist's Handbook, and his essay on why people shouldn't support so-called humane animal farming was included in Eating Animals, one of the most well-known books on vegetarianism. For decades, he's been known for his willingness to go to great lengths to effect change. In 1993, Friedrich was running a Catholic homeless shelter and a Catholic soup kitchen in Washington, D.C. He and 3 other peace activists, including the famed priests Philip Berrigan and John Deere, decided to take nonviolent action based on the Book of Isaiah's Swords to Plowshares passage. They trekked through water and rough terrain and snuck past hundreds of Air Force personnel to reach a nuclear-capable Strike Eagle F-15E fighter plane. They proceeded to hammer and pour blood on the plane. On the ground next to the plane, they placed a statement of their intent as peace activists belonging to the Plowshares movement along with a banner that read, "Disarm and Live." As one would expect, they were quickly arrested, charged, tried, and found guilty. The jury hearing Friedrich's case took only 6 minutes to return its verdict. He was sentenced to 15 months in jail, 3 years of probation, and $2,700 in restitution. The furthest Friedrich has gone to help others has actually been his career transition away from these confrontational, provocative tactics and toward the corporate approach of GFI. We might want to answer a moral crime of the magnitude of animal farming with loud, drastic action. That's what it deserves. But that's not necessarily what the animals need. To find out what's best for those we want to help, it is crucial that we apply evidence and reason to find the best way to allocate our limited resources. Friedrich considered this, and he concluded that he needed to go against his gut instincts. He put down his hammer and put on a suit. While some might diverge from Friedrich's approach and decide that the evidence weighs in favor of drastic action and against a more moderate stance, it's important that advocates make evidence-based decisions that utilize both their hearts and their heads. Since GFI's founding, the nonprofit has built relationships across the animal-free food industry with scientists, investors, entrepreneurs, and other advocates. One of their first projects was mapping out the field with technological readiness assessments, a methodology developed by NASA and now used by various government entities to help organizations understand and evaluate progress in their field. GFI has also helped secure positive media attention for the industry. In the first year, they were featured or had op-eds in the Washington Post, Wired, Vice, and the Los Angeles Times. In early 2016, GFI helped launch Memphis Meats, a startup developing cultured meat, real meat made without killing animals, earning that company coverage in the Wall Street Journal and other major media outlets. While MFA was launching GFI, it was also creating a second organization, the $25 million venture capital fund New Crop Capital, NCC. NCC has funded Memphis Meats and other companies supported by GFI, focusing on early-stage investments for companies working to disrupt the animal agriculture industry. The 1-2 punch of these organizations provides a near-ideal environment for animal-free food companies to incubate and flourish. Which products do we prioritize? One question the movement faces is which products to focus on first: beef, chicken meat, dairy, eggs, or a non-food product like leather. While this might seem mundane, there is actually huge variation in the amount of good one can do by working on each product. First, we need to evaluate the harm caused by each product by putting together, one, the calories per animal — you get a lot more meat from a cow than a chicken — two, the lifespan of each animal on the farm, and three, an economic factor called elasticity, which is the estimate of how much a change in one unit of demand affects production. Putting these together, we get the following. Per 500 calories consumed, chicken meat leads to an estimated average of 3.0 days of those animals living in factory farms or similar conditions. Turkey causes 0.8 days. Battery cage eggs cause 6.3. And farmed fish causes approximately 27.5 to 159.1, varying based on species and location. Meanwhile, perhaps surprisingly, beef and pork consumption cause 3.8 hours and 7.6 hours, respectively, and 500 calories of milk consumption is estimated to cause about 17.5 minutes. The trend here is that consuming smaller animals leads to far more suffering per calorie because it takes far more animals. We also want to consider the varying treatment of each animal on the farm, during transport, and at slaughter, as well as environmental and human health considerations. The calculations for those are beyond the scope of this book, but the result seems to be that the animal products maintain a similar ranking of harm caused, with the size of the animal still being the dominant factor. One exception to the size rule is the unusual case of bivalves, particularly oysters and mussels. These two creatures are animals by definition, yet they lack most of the behavior and neuroanatomy that we typically associate with consciousness. Instead, they are more like plants, sitting in one place and reacting in relatively simple ways to their environment. For this reason, some thoughtful eaters identify as bivalve vegans. Vegan, with the exception of eating bivalves, usually just oysters and mussels, because those species tend to be immobile and therefore have less likelihood of sentience. In addition to the harm caused, we need to consider social, technological, and culinary factors. For example, we know that dairy, in particular cheese, is so often cited as the deal-breaker for would-be vegans. This means that high-quality plant-based dairy could be a powerful social lever. Additionally, some dairy and egg products, like mayonnaise, are much easier to produce with plants because they have a homogeneous texture and significant non-animal-derived flavors, such as lemon juice. So starting with them could more easily establish the viability of plant-based foods. Consumers might also be more open to swapping out animal-based foods when the animal-based ingredients are less salient, as well as in non-food situations like wearing shoes made from plant-based leather. All things considered, it seems the movement should prioritize reducing the consumption of chicken meat, eggs, and fish meat because of the massive harm associated with these products. However, in the next few years, as plant-based foods are still establishing a consumer foothold, it makes sense to focus on dairy and egg products that are much easier from a culinary and technological perspective. Follow your heart or follow the impact. In 1970, four young vegetarian men with long hair and bushy beards were each hoping to find purpose in Southern California. Bob Goldberg, Paul Lewin, Michael Besanson, and Spencer Windbeal. Besanson had just traveled to Mount Shasta in Northern California because it was believed to be a focal point for spiritual energy. Inspired by this journey and a natural food conference, he decided to start a vegetarian lunch counter in the back of a health food store founded in Los Angeles by Johnny Weissmuller, the actor and Olympian swimmer who portrayed Tarzan in movies of the 1930s and 1940s. In 1973, the store was up for sale, and the four men bought it with the goal of taking all meat products off the shelves. They renamed the store Follow Your Heart. Despite naysayers, success came quickly. In Goldberg's words, instead of crashing and burning immediately, the store became very successful. I think what people hadn't realized was how comfortable it is for somebody who doesn't want to be around those meat products to go to a store where they can eat anything. When the store's supplier of eggless mayonnaise went out of business, Goldberg went to work on a replacement. That mayo went on to become Veganaise, a longtime vegan favorite and Follow Your Heart's flagship product, and the team started developing other products. Eventually, the company shifted its main focus to product development. Today, its product lineup includes block cheese, shredded cheese, cream cheese, ranch dressing, blue cheese dressing, and other plant-based dairy products. The company targets health-focused consumers who want non-GMO, organic, gluten-free, or soy-free foods. Their production facility is called Earth Island and is powered by an array of rooftop solar panels. Goldberg told a reporter in 2016 that his inspiration to replace eggs with plant protein came to him in a dream. Follow Your Heart continues to innovate in important ways. In 2015, it released a new product, Vegan Egg, which is made from algae and is probably the best animal-free egg product on the market today, often used for scrambles and omelets. Despite Follow Your Heart's success, Goldberg has rejected every offer from outside investors wanting to cash in on the growing demand for animal-free foods. He says, "It's very difficult for companies to grow and maintain their values, and I'm very focused on that." When I spoke to Goldberg on the phone, his commitment to purity and high-quality food was palpable. He was clearly dedicated to making Follow Your Heart a wholesome, immaculate company, and many vegans over the past few decades have been thankful for that. But thinking about the total impact the company could have in reducing the harms of animal farming makes me worry that his focus on purity might come at a significant cost to our food system. Even if a focus on growth were to lead to some sacrifice in values, and I'm honestly not sure it would, I suspect that the impact from the acquisition of new customers and the expanded reach of the company's ideology of compassion would quickly outweigh any loss from the perspective of the desperate animals in our food system. While value-centric companies like Follow Your Heart have been the saving grace of dairy-hungry, high-income vegans over the past few decades, their approach might come with high opportunity cost. Those forlorn animals don't care about our purity. They just want to be free from suffering by whatever means necessary. Some advocates worry that giving any ground on their end goal, such as by using non-organic ingredients if they are aiming for an organic food system, could make it harder to achieve that ideal outcome. There is a case to be made for radicalism, as it could push public discussion forward. But it seems to me that there's a best-of-both-worlds solution for most advocates to express radical goals while supporting practical, sometimes partial, solutions. Another company thinking about artisan appeal and big-picture change is Miyoko's Kitchen. Miyoko Shinner, the founder and chairman of the company, didn't eat much dairy as a child living in Japan. One day, after she moved to America at the age of 8, she got to try pizza at a friend's party. In her words, she was excited to become a true American. At first, she hated the gooey, fatty cheese, but like many Americans, she quickly became hooked. The fried rice and bento boxes she brought to lunch were oddities in California's schoolyards, and her mother took cooking